just to start off here, we're going to go way back, I guess. We're going to go to growing up in Indiana. Tell me about your home life, about your family. Just give me some insight into what life was like before you were drafted at 20 years old.
Salem, Indiana at that time was a real small community, 2,800, maybe 3,000 at the most. Probably, I would call it a farming community. And no matter which way you drive out of town, you see nothing but cornfields, you know. And life in Salem was just, it was like most small towns in those days. Everybody knows everybody else's business, you know. You know everybody in that town practically because it's so small. And I feel like it was a normal upbringing. But I think that people might disagree with this, but I feel like I was a real naive young man that didn't know anything about life outside of this little community, like in a big city or in the world at large. Because after I went to Vietnam, after I got there and realized what was going on, my whole view of the world changed right then and there. Because I went there one person, I came back another. So life growing up is just going to the swimming pool in the summertime and hanging out at the local, you know, Dairy Freeze or whatever it was at the time. Dairy Castle is what it was. And there wasn't anything to do there. There wasn't anything for kids to do except hang out, go to the roller rink, you know. That's all there was.
Mm-hmm. Do you have brothers or sisters?
I have one sister. She's 2 years older. And she's an RN. And also she's in real estate. So, and she's in Florida. So
you have a nice place to go visit and enjoy the
Yes,
nice
I also
weather.
Lived down there myself for about 11 years, so that may be part of where my southern accent comes from also. Salem, Indiana, by the way, is just about 30 miles northwest of Louisville, Kentucky.
How much, you said that you went in pretty naive to the war, but leading into being drafted in 69, I'm sure you had some indication that you would be drafted.
Well, all young men back then were afraid of being drafted because the kill rate in Vietnam, the number of soldiers dying was just tremendous. And so everybody was afraid of being drafted. A lot of people joined, enlisted, so they could choose their job. If you're drafted, you don't have any choice. If they say you're going to be in the infantry, you're going to be in the infantry. That's all there is to it. So I just took potluck and came out in the artillery, which is not much better.
Do you ever regret not enlisting and maybe having a choice? Or were you holding out that maybe you wouldn't be drafted?
Well, I knew I was going to be drafted. You know, sooner or later, the war was at the time when I was drafted, the war was at its height. There were 550-some thousand. People there at one time, soldiers there at one time. That's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Did it make it worse? I mean, you came in pretty soon after the Tet Offensive, which is one of those battles that everyone seems to remember from the Vietnam War because of how bad it was.
Yeah, it was really bad. And my job when I first came in was there was a Tet counteroffensive of 1969 that started about 6 months after the Tet Offensive. And I was in all those battles.
So tell me a little bit more about what it meant to be in the field artillery in Vietnam. What kind of things did you do? I mean, how much traveling was involved throughout the country or throughout southern Vietnam? How much movement did you see?
Well, my idea of the artillery was they stay put and shoot long distances and they don't move much. But I was on the smallest 105 howitzer. That's the smallest artillery piece they make, and they're very maneuverable. They can move them by helicopter. So we moved 17 times in the 13 months I was there. So we moved a lot for an artillery unit, and we would just sit down and we would build from scratch a little base just out in the middle of nowhere.
So you were really exposed.
Well, completely. We were right there with the infantry at all times. So we would go out, we would actually go out sometimes even before they did to build, to get a little base, to get some wire around the base like you see around prisons, two rows of wire, and then sandbags up and make a little hut or a little bunker. All of our ammo bunkers were made out of these railroad, like the road drainage pipes you see that are real big, they cut them in half, and they just set them on the ground. You put two layers of sandbags over them, and that's where you sleep, inside one of those, or that's what covers the ammo, and the only thing protecting you is those two rows of barbed wire outside, and then we put claymore mines behind all around them, and that's to try to stop anybody from getting through, which a lot of times it doesn't. So yeah, it's completely exposed, you know, and so we and the infantry, that's where we sleep, right there in that little camp, encampment. Usually they would go out, the infantry would go out ever so many 800 yards or a mile or 2 miles or whatever till they encounter Viet Cong, and then they would pull back and we would start firing in.
So they went out actively searching for the locations of the Viet Cong, and that's where you knew her to fire with the 105.
Right. A lot of times our barrels would be completely horizontal, shooting straight because they were that close, you could see them coming. So
was it a constant just gunshots and battle? Was it?
It was every day. I can't remember a day that there wasn't a battle going on. I mean, some being in the artillery, some of the battles were a lot further away. I mean, these guns would shoot up to 7 miles, but there was always, we weren't always in direct fire with the Viet Cong right in our faces, but we were always shooting a battle, helping someone somewhere else, even if it was miles away. And the Viet Cong were always trying to come in to camp. And they had what they called sapper teams, which would be like a little squad. They were like the kamikazes of World War II. They went in with they were a suicide squad, knowing that they were going to try to come in your encampment and blow you to bits before you could catch them doing it. And that was their job. That's how they came into fire base encampments.
Is there a safe spot? Was there a safe spot anywhere? Did you ever feel safe?
No. Never. That was one of the horrors of Vietnam for me, was the feeling of impending doom at any time, knowing that at any given second, your life could be snuffed out. And I don't know about other soldiers, but the whole time, I was there 13 months in a week, and the whole time I was there, that's the way I felt. And I still have that feeling at times now. That's got a lot of what post-traumatic stress got to do with, is not being able to get over those feelings.
Help me understand how you felt. I mean, is it a pain in your gut? Is it a constant extra vigilance that you're just...
It's hypervigilance, just magnified so big that you just can't believe the feeling. It's an anxiety disorder that just makes you feel like you're just going to come right out of your skin, you know, literally. You feel like you'd feel better if you could just pull your skin off. I've never felt anything. I've been hurt in a lot of ways and through my entire life, but I've never had any worse feeling than that, you know. That's what causes a lot of suicides. That's why there's so many suicides with combat veterans.
When did the feeling start, before you got to Vietnam or when you got into the country?
Actually, it started when we went in country. When we came in country, there were 250 of us, and they set us on a bleachers, and there was whoever the captain was speaking told us that there was going to be a lot of us that weren't going to be going home. And we needed to be aware of that. And I think he told us that so we would realize the situation we were in. Because when you're 18 or 20 and you're a boy or becoming a man, you think you're invincible. And that was so poignant to me that it just hit home right then and there that my life is in danger at any second and I might not make it home. And a lot of those 250 didn't, obviously.
Were you ever mad at him for saying that to you?
No, because it woke me up. It made me realize, because, you know, as I said about the 18 and 20-year-old not taking it seriously, you know, you really don't when you're that old. You think you're invincible. You think you can do anything, no matter what, you know, and you're going to live through it. But, you know, you don't know what war is all about. It's just something you see on TV, and that's not the way war is. It's not like you see it on TV.
Did you have friends die?
I don't know that I did. I had friends hurt really bad, You know, I lost my gunner and my assistant gunner both on the gun. After I was there for about 7 months, I became the gun chief. You work yourself up the ladder like you do in any job, starting from the bottom. You work yourself up to the top man, and I became the top man after 7 months. And I lost a gunner and assistant gunner right off my gun and with me right there. You know, I feel like I was just lucky. If you got shrapnel flying around you and it's not hitting you, I feel like it's, you know, God's gift or something. But there was a lot of people hurt, and a lot of people went home, and some went home dead, you know. Some of them that went home dead, I didn't know.
Did you keep in contact with your sister and your parents back in Indiana?
Yes, I did. I kept in contact with my mother just by riding, but I became so distraught over there that there was actually a period of 2 or 3 months where I didn't ride at all, and my mother actually contacted the I can't think who it is now, one of the big agencies, Red Cross, in our little hometown or wherever they were, the closest office was, and they actually came to where I was in the field and said, "Ride home." You know, your parents are worried about you. So I did start riding home, but I was pretty upset over there, and as a lot of people were. I mean, killing somebody is a hell of a thing, you know. When you're taking somebody else's life, you know that your actions are responsible for people dying. You know, it's as devastating to me right now as it was then.
Do you think that's what's fueled a lot of your PTSD, is the act of killing, or do you think it's more the stress that you went through?
Well, I think it's just the fact of knowing that, you know, being brought up a Christian, you know, do not kill. I can remember telling my mother and my aunt one time that I couldn't go to heaven because of what I did in Vietnam. And that's a hell of a feeling. I can't help it. That's just, you know, what do you do with that? There's nothing you can do with it. If you're a Christian, that's what the book says.
Did you have that feeling while you were there?
I did have that feeling while I was there. And it was just, as I said earlier, just the feeling of impending doom all the time, I think, is what brings on this thing they call PTSD and what makes people depressed also. And I think the PTSD is worse than depression, because the PTSD is an anxiety disorder, and the anxiety becomes so high, it's so strong, that that's what makes people want to kill themselves, because you feel that your body is so uncomfortable.
Did you ever share that with maybe your higher commanders, that you don't want to kill anybody, that you're having these feelings? I mean, do you discuss that at all? Or did you, at the time, I mean, did you feel the need to get out, to ask someone to let you leave?
Actually, I didn't, because I could have gotten out of the service because I couldn't pass basic training because I had an injury. If you can't pass basic training, they turn you down and send you home. And I could have gone home because I had an injury on my Achilles tendon collapsed, and I couldn't pass the test, the basic training test. So I had an out right there, and I chose to be wavered through anyway. You can be wavered through if you choose. And I did that because I didn't want to go home like I'd been turned down because I wasn't good enough. You know, I had that's that 18, 20-year-old mentality thinking, you know, I'm a He-Man, you know, I want to go on through and do this. And the same thing when you get to Vietnam, you don't want to feel like a crybaby or act like a crybaby going and saying, "Look, I don't want to kill people. I don't want to shoot these guns. I don't want to be in this combat situation." You know, it's that macho image you want to have as a kid of being strong. Like that's what men are supposed to do. They're supposed to be strong and suck it up. But you know, some of them, they've never figured out how come some people do suck it up, and there was actually men that actually like combat, and there was actually men that go back and do more of it because they like it, you know. And those kind of men, I'm really in question of. You know, I don't want to say anything bad about anybody like that, of course, but I would never do that again, you know, of my own volition.
And you had the option to continue in the military, and you would even have gotten $10,000 for
absolutely. Whatever. You could buy a house for $10,000 back then. And I can remember when I was getting ready to leave, they came up to, I don't remember who it was that came up to me and said, you know, I was waiting on my orders for sergeant already wearing a sergeant acting stripe and waiting on orders for E5 sergeant, and they offered me E6 sergeant, which would be two raising ranks, and $10,000, because I was the gun chief at that time. And that was a lot of money back then. But I would have had to sign up for 6 more years and stay in Vietnam right then for another year and not go home at all. And I've had nightmares ever since then about starting to get on my plane to go home and someone coming up and stopping me and saying, you have to stay here one more year. I still have a recurring nightmare about that all the time. And that's as frightening as any combat nightmare to me.
What? How do you react when you have that nightmare?
I wake up in a cold sweat, and I still to this day have violent nightmares. Not every night, but not on a regular basis. It's kind of they come and they go. Sometimes they're bad for a week. Sometimes they might be bad for 2 weeks. Sometimes it may be 2-3 months in between them. But I have them, and you know, I've hurt myself in bed. I find myself on the floor. I've hurt my significant other. So still to this day, 39 years later, it still goes on. The fight goes on.
Do you think it will ever stop?
I don't. I mean, I'm under care. I've been in treatment for 5 years now. And one of my therapists told me, he said, there's no cure for post-traumatic stress disorder. And he said, it won't kill you, but it'll make you kill yourself. So you have to be in treatment.
Why, you're now 60 years old. You didn't start treatment until 5 years ago when you were 55.
That's right.
What was it that pushed you finally to say, I'm going to get treatment for this?
I had a suicide attempt. And I had been sick with this for, well, I had what they call delayed onset. It was about 10 years before it really started having a big effect on me. It had an effect on me, but after about 10 years, it just really hit with me, and I started having violent nightmares, and I got real depressed. I started crying a lot, you know, when I was by myself about it, you know, feeling bad about, you know, thinking that I wouldn't be able to go to heaven because of what I did in Vietnam. A lot of guilt. I had survivor guilt also, that, you know, why did I survive and lose my gunner and my sister and gunner both on each side of me? Why did that happen? So, I mean, a lot of combat veterans definitely to this day still feel survivor guilt. And I've also been in therapy with men from World War II. I've been in therapy with a man that was up in his 80s in World War II combat veteran, and he was in a post-traumatic stress disorder group because he had been like this all his life and didn't know why either. So it's out there. I mean, veterans, even that far back, and I'm sure World War I veterans, there are very few of them alive, but if you could talk to a bunch of the combat veterans, I bet you could find it in them also.
And post-traumatic stress disorder didn't really become a diagnosis until the 80s.
That's right. It didn't. When I got out of the service, there was no such thing as post-traumatic stress disorder. They called it battle fatigue, or shell-shocked is what they used to call it. But they still didn't know what that was. It wasn't studied. It was just something they thought that happened to a few veterans who went crazy. And there's a few of them that go crazy, so we'll call them shell-shocked and just say that's what, they're just kind of nuts after the war.
Did the VA offer you treatment? Did they push that you should go see a psychiatrist?
They did not. And as a matter of fact, I wasn't encouraged to go to the VA at all then. I was actually encouraged to go to my own family doctor.
Why? Can you give me some insight into that?
Don't know why. They told me that, I remember them telling me when I went home that you're probably going to get sick because of the change in the weather, you know, which I did. I got real sick. I actually had to go to the hospital. And but I can remember them telling me you need to see your family doctor. They didn't say go to the VA. They didn't say you had benefit. I didn't even realize I had any benefits. I didn't realize I had any benefits till 1993.
You came back in 1970s.
Came back in 1970s. It's a big part of my own fault, because a lot of the Vietnam veterans, because of the way they were treated, hated the government, which I did. And they didn't want anything to do with the military, and they didn't want anything to do with the VA. And I wouldn't go if they would have paid me.
Did you hate the government because they sent you to Vietnam?
I hated the government because of the way that we were treated when we came home. We were treated like, you know, they called us baby killers. You know, there was some incidents where there was what they call today collateral damage, where civilians were killed. And there was an incident in Vietnam where they said it was on purpose, you know. And that's also when the age of drugs had come into play all through the world, actually. And a lot of those drugs were coming from Vietnam at that time, and a lot of the soldiers were on drugs, smoking marijuana or whatever, you know. So they thought that the Vietnam veterans wound up with this reputation of being, you know, crazed drug people, soldiers on drugs, killing civilians, and that's why they got such a bad reputation, and that wasn't true. It just was not true at all. There may have been incidents, but there's incidents in every war where there's collateral damage and civilians are killed. Wasn't any more of that going on in Vietnam than that's going on right now in Iraq. It's a part of war, you know. Civilians get killed. Soldiers get killed by their own people. It's just part of what happens in war. But some of the Vietnam War was so unpopular because it was just like this war right now in Iraq. There's no reason for it whatsoever. It's this politics and bureaucracy is the only reason that the Vietnam War was happening, and it's the only reason this war is going on in Iraq right now.
And you didn't tell anyone that you were a Vietnam vet either. You tried to hide it.
I did hide it, because there were people back in those days that if you were a young man and you're hanging out in a bar, you've had a couple of beers, and you start talking about being a Vietnam veteran, you might have to fight your way out of the bar, which happened to me. And it's happened to many. I've heard that kind of story over and over and over about having to come home and fight your own people because you admitted you was a Vietnam veteran.
Who was it that wanted to fight you?
The American people. They didn't like Vietnam veterans because of the stigma. They thought Vietnam veterans were drug users and killers. They thought they went over there and murdered the civilian population in Vietnam because of what happened in what they called the My Lai Massacre. Lieutenant Calley was convicted of going into a village and killing everybody in the village. And from that moment on, that stigma stuck with the Vietnam veteran till this very day. People still think that. That may have happened. It may not have happened. I don't know. But if it did happen, that doesn't mean it happened everywhere. But that stigma stuck with everybody that went to Vietnam.
Do you think, it sounds like they're doing the reenactments.
I believe there was a cannon.
Yeah, that's a cannon.
I believe there was a howitzer that just went off.
I wanted to ask you, you tell about back, I mean, you brought up the comparison between Vietnam and Iraq. And there's another comparison that I really hadn't made until I was reading some of your writing. And you pointed out that suicide bombers that we hear so much about today in Iraq, that was a large issue in Vietnam as well. You had children with grenades and
exactly.
and many civilians. How did you view the Vietnamese people knowing that was happening?
Vietnam was so different than any other war there's ever been because the Viet Cong wore no uniforms. They dressed like the South Vietnamese people. So you didn't know if you were talking to a soldier or civilian, or Viet Cong. You didn't know if the person you were talking to was in the South Vietnamese Army, or you didn't know if the person was a civilian, or you didn't know if the person was in VA, North Vietnamese Army, or a Viet Cong, because they didn't have any uniforms, and they did that on purpose. That's the idea was of guerrilla warfare had never been. Our armies had never been in guerrilla warfare. Most of the war was fought at night. In the daytime, you'd very seldom ever find the Viet Cong. They had tunnels and they had hospitals and communities underground. And to this day, one of the main tourist attractions in Vietnam is the tunnels of Cu Chi, which was my 25th Infantry Division's base camp when I was there. So when I was there, they had tunnels all under this, all around this base camp when I was there, and nobody even knew it. To this day, now you can go over there and tour them.
That's fascinating.
It is fascinating.
How did you hear from World War II veterans that they didn't mind? The Germans were fine. They became friends with some of the Germans. They weren't supposed to talk to them, but they did because they were just soldiers too. And same with, you know, from other countries as well. They didn't have really a hatred. It was different for the Japanese, but for those Germans, I mean, they really didn't have an issue. I mean, so it sounds like you really maybe built up a strong hate for your enemy, which is unique to some war conflicts.
I actually didn't do that myself. I'm sure the soldiers did, but I didn't, because I didn't know those people from anyone else. And the only reason we were there supposedly was to stop the spread of communism, which I can understand that, because we don't want communism to rule the world. We were so afraid that Russia was so big and powerful at that time. We were afraid that we might be taken over by Russia, and America would lose their freedom. We wouldn't be a free country anymore because we would be ruled by someone else. So we didn't, even though Vietnam was such a small little country, we didn't want to spread. So that's why we went there to start with.
And really, it was a larger battle than just Vietnam. It was that battle between democracy or America and communism.
That's exactly what
but
it was.
But it took place at Vietnam.
But it turned, after a few years, it turned into something else mm-hmm. altogether. It turned into politics and bureaucracy and making money. There's always, the economy's always good when there's a war going on a lot of times. Now, that's not true today, but it was then. The economy was great back then, they say. I don't really recall, but that's what I hear.
Mm-hmm. I think we learned that from World War II, too, that pulled us out
exactly.
of the Depression. Tell me where you were and how you learned that the war was going to be ended in Vietnam.
Well, I was an upset man at that time, and I wasn't following the war. It was, you know, 5 years later is when the war ended after I left. And, I knew it started winding down actually 3 years after I left. It didn't really have a big effect on me. What the effect it did have was the fact that they pulled out and were considered losers, you know, of the war, which the America has this thing about just leaving a war, you know. It's kind of unheard of, you know. We didn't really lose the war, we just left. And that's what they want to happen right now in Iraq, you know. They don't want to consider it losing the war, but they just want to pick up and leave. So that's what happened in Vietnam. They just picked up and left. But it was made to look like on TV, because the North Vietnamese Army, the Viet Cong, were coming into Saigon at the very last minute that they were getting people out of Saigon off rooftops in helicopters, which made it look like we were run right out of Vietnam, and they were right on our tail. And I got out when they did. When we did, everybody would have been killed right there that was left there. But that's the way. That's the way I still see that picture, and that's what I hate about it, and that's what really sets me off when I think about it, is the idea that the Vietnam veterans lost the war in Vietnam, which is not true. It was the government. It was actually the civilian population forcing the government to get out of Vietnam, because they'd been there 15 years. 15 years, and over 58,000 young boys killed.
Things have changed for you now, where you've decided to seek treatment and embrace the VA in a way again. And you also encourage other veterans to do that. Why, you said it was the suicide attempt that led you to seek treatment. Was it also that the VA has changed in how welcoming they are of soldiers, particularly Vietnam soldiers?
At first, I didn't know. I just knew I needed help, and I wound up in an emergency room at a VA hospital in Florida. My sister took me there because I didn't have any other choice. I did have a suicide attempt, and I was really distraught, and she took me straight to the emergency room, and that's when I started getting help. And I had tried before a couple times, and it just didn't work for me. And but this time there was a doctor that sat down with me, and I'd already been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder but wouldn't accept help for it about 6 years earlier. And this doctor didn't know that. It was a different hospital. And she came into my room and sat down beside me on my bed and talked to me for a long time. And she said, "You have post-traumatic stress disorder." And she wrote me a personal letter, which usually a doctor doesn't do that. She wrote this letter for me, and she said, "I want you to take this and file a claim for post-traumatic stress disorder." And she wrote a very poignant letter to the regional office for me to get post-traumatic stress disorder. And she was kind of like the doctor that I have now. She was a psychiatrist, and I could tell that she was there to help, and that was the only reason she was doing her job. That doesn't happen with all doctors.
So it was the right person at the right time for
you? It was the right person at the right time for me, and it was also a time in my life where I knew that if I didn't get help, I probably wasn't going to live a lot longer. So I put out all the effort I could to try to accept the help they were offering, and it started working for me. And it's 5 years later now, and things are good. But during all this time, I've come to find out that the VA has changed. They've made it a point, and I made it a point of my own to kind of do my own investigations and just through my own experience with them, finding out that there are new directives coming down from Washington, D.C. on a regular basis on changing the treatment of veterans due to what happened with the Vietnam veterans. They don't want to make that kind of mistake with the veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq. It's said right now they're already expecting 50,000 cases so far of post-traumatic stress disorder from those veterans, and they don't want to turn, my doctor told me they don't want to turn 50,000 veterans out on the street with post-traumatic stress disorder like they did the Vietnam veterans. Mm-hmm. And when she told me this, and I still, to this day, I didn't believe her. I mean, to this day, I was still that mistrustful of the government after being helped, after having this much help for this long, I still didn't trust. So she took me to the public affairs officer at the VA, and she reiterated what my doctor had told me, and I said, "My God, this must be true. I still really don't believe it." But she went ahead and showed me a handful of directives that she had coming from Washington on how veterans are to be treated. And right then and there, it changed my life. It changed my whole way of thinking, made me feel better about myself, made me feel so much better about the VA. I couldn't believe it, that they were really out to try to help all veterans, and especially because of the treatment that happened with the Vietnam veterans.
Did you feel better about yourself because finally it's a way of the government saying, "We're sorry, we were wrong, they should have been treated better"?
Exactly. That's exactly the way I felt. And I had this idea about getting this message out, because I know there were still many, many thousands of Vietnam veterans out there that's never been to a VA, I'm sure. I know it. I know one myself right now in Sioux Falls that had never been to a VA because of this, the way the veterans were treated. So I know there's, you know, I just figure if there's one I could help, or I could change his opinion about the VA and make him feel better about himself and his country and get help as I did, there's still veterans out there today that can still get help and come into the VA and accept services because they're there for them and they want to help.
Mm-hmm. How much are you concerned about those veterans, particularly with PTSD, who aren't getting help?
I'm real concerned about them because, you know, they're young men. They're just now getting their life started when their tours are over and they're out of the service. But I've already heard word that I know is true. I know it's fact. I've checked on it. That there are veterans right now that are not accepting the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder because they're afraid they'll lose their job or their insurance. And it's happening right now, and it's a shame. The VA changing their outlook toward the veterans is one thing, but getting companies to see post-traumatic stress disorder as not being such a bad thing that people can still function and have normal lives as long as they stay in treatment. So yeah, it's a big deal to me. I'm afraid that, well, I know there are veterans out there that's not even today, there are veterans that's going to get a bad attitude about it, and they're going to wind up just like me. And it's going to be 30 or 40 years later, if they're lucky, before they ever get help, if they wind up with a bad attitude and just not accept help like so many veterans have done that I know. Big deal.
What was your life like for those 30, 40 years that you weren't getting treatment?
Substance abuse. You know, most people that have post-traumatic stress disorder and that have depression diagnoses, you know, they start, you know, medicating themselves. That's the only thing they know to do, so they start drinking, you know, or using drugs. I went through the whole realm, you know, of drug abuse and alcohol abuse both for years. I mean, I worked jobs, and I had some decent jobs. I had the potential of making a lot of money in one profession I was in, but the bad attitude and just the more the drinking than anything. Just there was a time when I couldn't go to sleep without drinking a few beers, because if I drank a few beers, I wouldn't have all these nightmares. And that became a habit and also turned me into an alcoholic. But I've been clean and sober for over 5 years now, and I'm very proud of that, and I'm not ashamed of what I went through. I was at one time, but you know, my doctors and therapists tell me that, you know, that I had to go through what I went through to get where I am now, and that's the way I look at it, and I wouldn't change that for anything.
Tell me about what your treatment is like, too. If we have some veterans that are listening now, and maybe they are suffering from some symptoms of PTSD, give them an idea of how often you go, what you do, what helps, what maybe doesn't help.
Actually, what helps me the most is I have one therapy session I go to now, which is a group therapy session, and it's all Vietnam veterans except for one. There's a Persian Gulf veteran or some, I believe that was the war he was in, but he's the only one. The rest are Vietnam veterans, and I sit there and I listen to them talk about feelings that I have that I can't talk to nobody else about but them. You know, I've had these feelings for 39 years and I feel the way I do, and I question myself about, why do I feel this way? Am I crazy? And I go in there to this meeting, and I hear every one of them go around the room and talk, and they're sharing the same feelings, they have the same problems that I have, and it makes me feel better about myself, knowing that someone else has the same problem. Group therapy is wonderful in that way, that it makes you feel like there's other people that have the same problems as you do, and you can even see some that are fighting it worse than you are. So it doesn't make you feel like you're the only one. And you can also have one-on-one therapy. I happen to have one-on-one therapy with a psychologist, which is unusual. And she's one of the nicest women and one of the nicest doctors I've ever met in my life. She's definitely an altruistic person. She's into doing this because she wants to help people. That's why she does her job. A lot of doctors are not that way. You're more like a number to them and not a person. And that doesn't happen so much, but it does happen. So she's very unique to me. I really think a lot of her. She helps me a lot. And a one-on-one therapy is a more intense therapy. And, you know, you can get down to, if you have much deep-rooted problems, if the problems are much deeper than you'd want to talk about in group therapy. It's there for anyone that wants it. And there was a time, and it hadn't been that many years ago, where the mental health facility at the VA hospital wasn't much going on there at all. Wasn't very many patients there, wasn't very many doctors there. And that hadn't been that long ago. I think maybe 10 years ago it was like that. And nowadays, you know, they're remodeling floors over there for the mental health facility, and because there's a great need, and all these directives that are coming from Washington, D.C., are the cause of that. And a big part of that is because of the way the Vietnam veteran was treated, and they want to see that everything change because they don't want all these new veterans being treated that way.
Mm. And I'm curious, too, you've been reaching out to the public through letters to the editor, to news media, and here today sharing your story because you want to get it out there. Do you think that that's part of your treatment as well? Is that something that helps to share your story with the general public, or maybe give you some purpose to share and hopefully encourage others to get treatment?
You know, having been in treatment for almost 5 years now, I still talk over with my psychologist that even though I'm better now, I feel better about myself, I still can't seem to find any purpose for my life because I feel so bad about what happened to me. Not that I'm feeling sorry for myself, but, you know, I've during the time that I wasn't receiving help, you know, I treated other people badly. I feel like I wasn't a good person, and I've never been able to get over that. It was really hard for me to ever get over that. And so I kept telling her, I can't find purpose in this life of mine. And when this way of thinking came to me, which she actually put the idea in my head, her name's Dr. Rebecca Watson, and she's a wonderful person. And she gave me this idea that the Vietnam veterans really have a great legacy that they've left because of the way they were treated. All veterans now are being treated much better because of that. And I just think if that word got out, it would change a lot of lives. Well, this new way of thinking has it's changed my life. It has given me purpose. I mean, I feel like I already know that just from the article that I'd written, I already know that it's changed a couple men's thinking at the VA. There was quite a buzz around the VA when all this came down. Dr. Watson told me she was being emailed by some of her peers wanting to know how she became such a celebrity all of a sudden. You know, the VA here in Sioux Falls has about 800 employees. So a lot of those employees either saw the interview on TV or read the letter in the Argus Leader. And so, I mean, she's sure that it's already affected some people's thinking, you know, about this whole subject. And for me, I don't really care about anything other than if it helps somebody. It just, the idea of it helping somebody makes me feel so good. That's all I care about, because it does give me purpose. It gave me purpose where I had a hard time finding any real purpose before. But now I do. You know, I'm going to keep it up as much as I feel comfortable.